to hand over Osama bin Laden. The United States turned up the pressure in late 1998 after al-Qaeda simultaneously bombed the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, but Pakistan's spy service was unmoved. The Americans in Pakistan sent a string of cables to Washington detailing their frustrations. One State Department cable from Islamabad in December 1998 carried a dry, understated subject heading, "Osama bin Laden, Pakistan seems to be leaning against being helpful." When one American diplomat brought up bin Laden's name during a meeting with General Ehsan ul Haq, a future ISI chief, the Pakistani general grew testy. "I cannot understand why you Americans are so concerned about Afghanistan," he snapped. On the morning of September 11, 2001, General Mahmoud Ahmed, the head of the ISI, happened to be in Washington meeting with lawmakers inside a secure chamber room of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. A short, stocky man with a bushy white mustache extending across the middle of both cheeks, Ahmed had taken over the ISI after the 1999 military coup that installed General Pervez Musharraf as president, and he did little to hide his sympathies for the Taliban. He once scolded a Pakistan military analyst who had told President Musharraf that Pakistan's policy toward the Taliban was hurting its standing with other nations. "The Taliban," the ISI chief said, "is the future of Afghanistan." On that morning on Capitol Hill, Ahmed was having a friendly exchange with Representative Porter Goss, the committee's top Republican, regaling the congressman with his knowledge of obscure facts about the American Civil War. Goss had wrapped a book about the Civil War to give to Ahmed as a gift, but the pleasantries were cut short when committee staffers raced into the meeting room to tell the lawmakers and the ISI chief that the second plane had just hit the World Trade Center. "Mahmoud's face turned ashen," recalls Goss. The Pakistani spymaster quickly excused himself from the meeting and jumped into the embassy car waiting for him. The book, still wrapped, was left inside the room. The following morning, General Ahmed was called to the office of Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, who was in no mood for diplomatic correctness. President Bush had announced the night before that the United States would treat both the terrorists and their patrons equally, and Armitage presented the ISI's dilemma in Manichaean terms. "Pakistan faces a stark choice. Either it is with us, or it is not," Armitage told the Pakistani spy chief, saying the decision was black and white, with no gray. Insulted by Armitage's bluntness, Ahmed responded that although Pakistan had long been accused of being in bed with terrorists, nothing could be further from the truth. His country would back the United States without hesitation, he said, assuring Armitage that Pakistan has always seen such matters in black and white. Armitage warned that the United States was preparing a laundry list of demands for Pakistan that were likely to cause deep introspection in Islamabad. The terms of the CIA-ISI marriage were discussed the next day. Armitage told General Ahmed that the United States wanted unfettered access to Pakistani airspace and the ability to carry out military and intelligence operations inside Pakistan. America also wanted access to Pakistani ports, airstrips, and bases in the mountains along the border with Afghanistan. Finally, he insisted that the ISI hand over to the CIA all the intelligence it had about al-Qaeda. Ahmed assured Armitage he would pass the list of demands to Musharraf, but, he said, Pakistan wanted something in return. Assurance that it would be reimbursed for its support in the campaign against al-Qaeda. If Pakistan was going to turn against the Taliban and agree to a war on its western border, it would need to be rewarded for it. The parameters of America's dysfunctional relationship with Pakistan in the post-9/11 era had been set. the United States insisted on the right to wage a secret war inside Pakistan, and Islamabad extracted money in return. President Musharraf had acceded to most, but not all, of Washington's requirements. For instance, he put limits on where American planes could fly in Pakistani airspace, fearing that the United States might try to conduct surveillance flights over Pakistani nuclear sites. He also denied the United States access to most military bases, allowing the American military to station personnel at only two air bases, Shamsi in the southwestern region of Balochistan and Jacobabad in the northern province of Sindh. In the end, Washington and Islamabad's renewal of their vows left both sides believing they had given up more than they were getting, creating recriminations and resentment that would boil over years later. The rhetoric from Washington had been unambiguous, and Musharraf knew it. A man who had spent his career in the military, he considered his options as if this were a war game. He later wrote in his memoir that if he had chosen to protect the Taliban, the United States would consider Pakistan a terrorist state and, for all he knew, would attack Pakistan, eviscerate Pakistan's military, and seize the country's nuclear arsenal. India had already offered its bases for the Afghan war, and Musharraf figured that soon enough the United States could be flying combat missions from a base in Amritsar in northwestern India. The bombers would streak over Pakistani territory on their way into Afghanistan and back again after they had delivered their deadly payloads. Even worse, the Indians could seize the opportunity to open an offensive in Kashmir with America's blessing. The strategic balance in South Asia, which had long aligned Pakistan with the United States against India and its historic ally Russia, would change permanently. Pakistan would be a crushed, impoverished outcast. On the evening of September 19th, Musharraf told the people of Pakistan how he had answered Washington's demands. He was dressed in a crisp military uniform, but his face was haggard and drawn, the toll of endless meetings with his generals, civilian politicians, religious leaders, and American diplomats. His televised speech was not a denunciation of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, and at no time did Musharraf condemn the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. He instead framed his decision to help America in narrow nationalistic terms. India had already pledged its full support to Washington, he said, and New Delhi was determined to ensure that if and when the government in Afghanistan changes, it shall be an anti-Pakistan government. He said that Pakistan had four priorities: the security of its borders, the Kashmir cause, the revival of its economy, and finally, the protection of its strategic assets. That final item on the list was not just a reference to the nuclear arsenal that Pakistan had built to destroy India. Pakistan's military had other strategic assets to consider. By 2001, groups like the Afghan Taliban and the militia network run by Mujahideen leader Jalaluddin Haqqani were considered critical elements of Pakistan's defenses, and Musharraf made it clear in the speech that night that he still regarded the Taliban as an important bulwark against India. Even as he was leaning on Mullah Omar to give up bin Laden, he told the country that the tactic was a way to emerge from the crisis without any damage to Afghanistan and the Taliban. Things weren't, in fact, black and white. 1 week after the September 11 attacks, and one night before President Bush, in front of a joint session of Congress, accused the Taliban of aiding and abetting murder, Musharraf was still hoping that the Taliban could remain in power. Washington had been comforted by the belief that Musharraf had pushed all of his poker chips to the center of the table on a bet on the Bush administration. In fact, he adopted a far more nuanced strategy, a strategy that even after more than a decade of war in Afghanistan, many American officials would still have difficulty discerning. The ISI was still hoping that another bloody Afghan war could be avoided, especially one that might replace the Taliban with the Tajiks and Uzbeks of the Northern Alliance. After General Ahmed returned to Islamabad, he implored American Ambassador Wendy Chamberlain not to start a war out of revenge. A true victory in Afghanistan, Ahmed said, would come only by negotiating. If the Taliban are eliminated, he said, Afghanistan will revert to warlordism. To try to convince Taliban leader Mullah Mohammed Omar to give up bin Laden, General Ahmed flew to Kandahar on a plane loaned by the CIA. Omar, a former Mujahideen commander who had lost one eye during the Soviet war, mocked the Pakistani general as the Bush administration's errand boy and rejected the demands. He issued a stinging rebuke to his longtime ISI benefactor. "You want to please the Americans, and I want to please God," he said. The Afghanistan strategy had created divisions in the CIA from the beginning, with rifts opening between officers at Langley and those posted at the CIA station in Islamabad. Kofor Black, the CTC chief, pressed to immediately arm the Northern Alliance and begin a push south toward Kabul. But Robert Grenier, the Islamabad station chief, fought against the plan. He warned that any move to arm a militia backed by India and Russia could immediately destroy relations with Pakistan just as they were thawing after years of mistrust. These internal fights got a wider audience 3 weeks after the September 11 attacks, when CIA officers went to the Pentagon for a teleconference between Washington, Islamabad, and United States Central Command Headquarters in Tampa. During the call, Grenier said that any ground offensive using the Northern Alliance ought to be put on hold to give the ISI more time to pressure the Taliban to release bin Laden. Backing the Northern Alliance could lead to another bloody Afghan civil war, Grenier said, adding that an air campaign could be enough for the time being to bring the Taliban to negotiations. But Hank Crumpton, a CTC officer who had been designated by Kofor Black to run the CIA's war in Afghanistan, thought Grenier was being naive. He was merely reflecting the ISI's position, Crumpton thought, and was displaying a bad case of clientitis. After the meeting, Crumpton told Rumsfeld he thought that Grenier was dead wrong. Grenier may have been channeling the concerns of the ISI, but they were hardly unreasonable worries. For weeks, ISI officials had been whispering to their CIA counterparts in Islamabad that a war in Afghanistan could spin wildly out of control. It would upset a delicate balance in the region, they said, perhaps even leading India and Pakistan toward a full-blown proxy war inside Afghanistan. As the negotiations dragged on and September turned to October, the CIA quietly began inserting paramilitary teams into Afghanistan to make contact with the warlord commanders who fought under the Northern Alliance banner. Meanwhile, a torrent of threat information continued to come into the agency's counterterrorist center from CIA stations in the Middle East and South Asia. On October 5th, 2 days before the United States dropped the first bombs on Afghanistan, Armitage sent an eyes-only cable to Ambassador Chamberlain demanding that she meet immediately with General Ahmed. He wanted a simple message delivered to Mullah Omar, and he wanted Ahmed to deliver it. If another attack was traced back to Afghanistan, Armitage wrote, the American response would be devastating. Every pillar of the Taliban regime will be destroyed. The day after America's war in Afghanistan began, Musharraf replaced General Ahmed at the ISI. CIA leaders in Washington had been pressing for General Ahmed to be sacked, and his replacement was an uncontroversial choice. General Hassan ul-Haq, an urbane commander who at the time was leading the Army's corps in Peshawar, had been part of the cabal of military leaders who installed Musharraf in power in 1999, and unlike Ahmed, he had no obvious loyalties to the Taliban. Within weeks, he was sitting by Musharraf's side at the United Nations, where Musharraf and Bush met for the first time since the September 11 attacks to discuss America's plans in Afghanistan. To prepare Bush for the meeting, Secretary of State Colin Powell wrote the president a memo that praised Musharraf and said, unequivocally, that Pakistan's government had abandoned the Taliban. President Musharraf's decision to fully cooperate with the United States in the wake of September 11th, at considerable political risk, abruptly turned our stalled relationship around, the memo began. In hindsight, Powell's analysis was naive. It was what American officials wanted to believe and chose to hear. Musharraf hadn't fundamentally shifted Pakistan's foreign policy as much as he had reprised a deal that General Mohammad Zia-ul-Haq, Pakistan's former president, had struck with the Americans during the 1980s. Musharraf would help the United States get what it wanted in Afghanistan, and Pakistan would be paid handsomely. Musharraf hadn't managed to prevent the war, but he wanted it to be short and for the United States to leave his neighborhood as quickly as possible. This is the message he brought to Bush at the United Nations. Do what you need to do to expel Osama bin Laden and his followers from Afghanistan. But the last thing the United States should do is stay in Afghanistan for years. As it turned out, the Pakistanis had misread the Americans just as badly as the Americans had misread the Pakistanis. In the months after the September 11 attacks, a string of intelligence cables from ISI headquarters went out to Pakistan's embassies in Washington and elsewhere. The spy service's analysts concluded that the United States had no plans for a long-term commitment to Afghanistan beyond the defeat of Al-Qaeda there, a conclusion that had been informed by the knowledge that Washington had lost interest in Afghanistan after the last war, as soon as the Soviets had withdrawn. This is how it appeared to Asad Durrani, a retired Pakistani lieutenant general who had run the ISI during the 1990s. Durrani was serving as Pakistan's ambassador to Saudi Arabia in late 2001 when the ISI cables began arriving in the foreign embassies. America's new war in Afghanistan, Durrani said years later, seemed as if it was going to be a very short-term affair. Pakistani spies were still trying to ensure that it was, and in November and December 2001, they held a series of secret meetings with Afghan tribal leaders to determine how many outer layers of the Taliban's followers could be peeled away from the movement's fanatical core. During one of these meetings, General Ehsan-ul-Haq, the new ISI chief, sat down with Jalaluddin Haqqani in Islamabad. General ul-Haq had called Haqqani to the capital to gauge the loyalties of the wizened militia leader. Haqqani had once been the CIA's greatest ally in Afghanistan during the war against the Soviets, but in the years since had pledged loyalty to Al-Qaeda and had built up a sprawling criminal empire from his base in Maranshah in northern Waziristan. It became clear during the meeting that Haqqani wasn't about to be turned. The American invasion of Afghanistan, Haqqani told General ul-Haq, was no different from the Soviet war years earlier. With chilling prescience, he predicted that the new war would play out just as the last one had. Haqqani said that he could not stop American bombers, but eventually the United States would have to send in large numbers of ground troops. When that happened, Haqqani told the ISI chief, he would be on level ground with the Americans. They can occupy all the cities, but they can't occupy all the mountains, the militia leader continued, as General ul-Haq recalls the meeting. So we will go to the mountains and we will resist, just like we did against the Soviet Union. News that the famous commander had been in Islamabad quickly spread to the American embassy, and CIA Station Chief Robert Grenier immediately visited General Ulhaq to get more information. Not only had Akani been in the capital, Ulhaq acknowledged, but he had met with him. He hadn't bothered to tell the CIA chief, he said, because nothing productive came from the meeting. "I don't think he is going to be helpful," Ulhaq said. Although he had installed a new general to lead the ISI, Musharraf's purge of Islamists inside the military went only so far. At the same time, General Ulhaq took over the military spy service. Musharraf appointed Lieutenant General Ali Jan Orakzai, a close friend and longtime Taliban sympathizer, to take over the army's corps in Peshawar, the same job that Ulhaq had just vacated. Peshawar, a bustling market city, is the capital of Pakistan's northwest frontier province, a territory named by the British for its position at the outer edge of the settled lands. The job in Peshawar also gave General Orakzai oversight over the federally administrated tribal areas, the harsh mountainous lands ruled by wild men of the Wazir and Masood tribes, and where the government's writ meant little. The British had had little success taming the tribal lands that had been part of the British Raj, and eventually gave up. As a 23-year-old journalist visiting India in 1897, Winston Churchill spent 6 weeks with Britain's Melican Field Force and sent dispatches to the Daily Telegraph describing the snow-capped mountains where range after range is seen as the long surges of an Atlantic swell, and in the distance some glittering snow peak suggests a white-crested roller higher than the rest. "The drenching rains which fall each year," Churchill continued, "have washed the soil from the sides of the hills until they have become strangely grooved by numberless watercourses, and the black primeval rock is everywhere exposed." Just as the lands had changed little since Churchill's time, the people of the tribal areas remained fiercely distrustful of outsiders. "It is a place," Britain's future prime minister observed, "where every man's hand is against the other, and all against the stranger." General Orakzai had long ago proven his loyalty to Musharraf as another of the military conspirators behind the 1999 coup. According to some accounts, it had been Orakzai who showed up at former President Nawaz Sharif's house, pointed a gun in his face, and told him that the military was taking charge in Pakistan. He was a commanding figure who had been raised in the tribal areas and had spent enough time in the mountains to know that regular Pakistani troops were not trained for the mission they were about to undertake. He told Musharraf he doubted there were many foreign Al-Qaeda operatives fleeing across the border into Pakistan. But CIA officers in Islamabad thought differently. Months after Pakistani soldiers moved into the tribal areas, CIA officers began feeding the ISI steady reports about the arrival of Arab fighters in the mountains, but General Orakzai's military patrols turned up nothing. Grenier, the CIA's Islamabad station chief, said that Orakzai and other Pakistani officials with whom he met worried that Pakistani troops rumbling through mountain villages could touch off a tribal uprising. The officials didn't want to believe that Al-Qaeda had established a new base in Pakistan, less than 100 miles from the bases in Afghanistan, where the group had planned the September 11 attacks. "It was an inconvenient fact," said Grenier. Orakzai held the Peshawar command until his retirement in 2004, and for years continued to deny the presence of Arab fighters in the tribal areas. In 2005, he told a reporter that the notion that Osama bin Laden might be hiding in Pakistan was purely conjecture, and he never saw any evidence that Arab fighters had set up operations in the tribal areas. "The hunt for bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in Pakistan," he said, "was pointless." But others knew better. Brigadier General Asad Munir had just assumed his post as the ISI's chief of station in Peshawar when the September 11 attacks occurred, and it wasn't long before the Americans began arriving there. They came in small numbers at first, no more than a dozen, and set up at the fortified U.S. consulate inside the city. It was late 2001, and they had come to work with their Pakistani counterparts to hunt down Al-Qaeda operatives escaping the fighting in Afghanistan. They had come to work with Asad Munir. I had never met a CIA man, Munir recalled, taking long drags of a Benson & Hedges cigarette, the smoke sometimes obscuring a face with the rugged looks of an aging Bollywood leading man. His thoughts turned wistfully to the early years after the September 11 attacks, when the spies of America and Pakistan seemed to be fighting the same enemy. We were just like friends. The Americans, led by a CIA officer named Keith, were at first suspicious of Munir and almost everyone else from the ISI. But after 2 weeks, Munir said, the suspicions had dissolved. Peshawar was the westernmost city in which the CIA could establish a large base, and by the middle of 2002, the agency had turned the American consulate there into a hub for espionage operations. Antennas were erected on the roof, new computers were installed, clandestine officers arrived using thin covers. It was, in effect, a spy station posing as a diplomatic outpost. Munir also remembered the other men who arrived, the technical people. Munir wouldn't have known, but the technical teams were part of a shadowy Pentagon unit called Gray Fox, officially the Army's intelligence support activity based at Fort Belvoir in Virginia, which sent clandestine officers around the world with special equipment to intercept communications. With their arrival, the database of suspicious cell phone numbers that the U.S.-Pakistani team used to track down Al-Qaeda around Peshawar and in the tribal areas expanded dramatically. 12 numbers turned into 100, 100 into 1,200. Names of Algerians, Libyans, Saudis, and others that neither the CIA nor the ISI had heard before were added to the roster, and the list grew like crazy, Munir said. Most of the foreigners that Munir and the Americans were hunting had moved into Pakistan between December 2001 and April 2002, having escaped from the American bombing campaign at Tora Bora and the Shaikot Valley in eastern Afghanistan. There were Arabs and Uzbeks and Chechens and natives of other Central Asian countries. Some were looking to make their way back to the Arab states of the Persian Gulf. Some were simply looking for a new home and began laying down roots by marrying local Pashtun women. Each day, the ISI and CIA operatives in Peshawar would pore over a thick stack of transcripts from intercepted conversations and then use the intelligence to plan raids to capture militants in and around Peshawar. The intelligence from the intercepts went only so far, and with a soda straw view of the war, the spies in Peshawar sometimes made arrests they would never have made if they'd had access to more information. Once, in June 2003, they traced the cell phone of an Algerian operative, Adil Hadi Al-Jazairi, to a large public swimming pool near Peshawar. When they arrived, they found more than 100 men in the pool. Without a photograph of Al-Jazairi, there was no way they could make the arrest. One of the ISI operatives called the phone number they suspected belonged to Al-Jazairi and watched as a bearded man swam to the side of the pool to pick up his ringing cell phone. A team of Peshawar policemen rushed to the man, dripping wet in his swimsuit. But they had accidentally arrested a double agent. Unbeknownst to them, Al-Jazairi had been informing on Al-Qaeda for Britain's MI6. The Algerian man was shipped to Guantanamo Bay, and British intelligence had one less informant. Years later, Munir keeps many of the spy stories to himself, sticking to a code he also expects his American partners to honor. He thinks about the respect that the two spy services once had for each other, respect that might even have been something approaching trust. It was a thoroughly enjoyable time, he said. and a moment that he knows can never be recreated because of the years of suspicion that would follow. The success of the operations led by Asad Munir and the CIA officers around Peshawar, together with the capture of senior bin Laden lieutenants like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib in other Pakistani cities, led many top Bush officials to believe that the partnership was working. The al-Qaeda figures in Pakistan were being whisked out of the country to Afghanistan, to Thailand, to Romania and other countries that had allowed the CIA to construct secret prisons on their soil. The CIA was sending millions of dollars to the ISI when the bills for Islamabad support came due. So lucrative had the arrangement become for the Pakistanis that a joke circulated in Islamabad that for each terrorist the ISI helped capture, two new ones needed to be created to keep the racket going. As Asad Munir saw it, the vague ambitions the ISI had in 2001 to maintain its ties to the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani network had, by 2003 and 2004, morphed into a carefully crafted strategy to use these groups to Islamabad's advantage for a post-war Afghanistan. The Pakistani analysis had been proven wrong. The war in Afghanistan had not turned out to be a short affair. Moreover, the decision by the Bush administration to invade Iraq in 2003 was proof to many in the Pakistani military and intelligence services that Washington had lost interest in Afghanistan and would once again make a chaotic exit from the country. Pakistan needed to protect itself. The Americans came to Afghanistan without having a plan in totality. How do we enter and how do we exit? Said Munir. They were not interested at that time in the Taliban. Their focus was on al-Qaeda. Pakistan did have second thoughts that these people, the Americans, are not going to secure Afghanistan, he said. We thought they will leave and we will have to live with the Afghans. He paused, taking another drag from his cigarette. We have our own interests and our own security concerns. Chapter 3. Cloak and Dagger Men. A quote by Senator Frank Church, 1976. Certainly we don't need a regiment of cloak and dagger men earning their campaign ribbons, and indeed their promotions, by planning new exploits throughout the world. Theirs is a self-generating enterprise. There was a time, not very long ago, when the CIA was out of the killing business. When Ross Newland joined the spy agency in the late 1970s, the CIA wasn't looking to pick any fights abroad. Newland was fresh out of graduate school, and the CIA was reeling from the body blows it had absorbed from congressional committees that had investigated the agency's covert actions since its founding in 1947. Congress was tightening its control over secret activities, and chastened CIA leaders began to refocus the agency's activities on stealing the secrets of foreign regimes, traditional espionage, rather than overthrowing them or trying to kill their leaders. President Jimmy Carter, who had campaigned to put an end to the CIA's overseas adventures, had installed Admiral Stansfield Turner at Langley, partly to rein in a spy agency he thought had run amok. Newland and a generation of CIA case officers who joined the agency during this period were told that the CIA would only invite trouble if it got back into the work of killing. By the end of his career, Newland would see the agency come full circle on the matter of lethal action, and he would come to question the wisdom of the CIA's embrace of its role as the willing executioner of America's enemies. The CIA had been established with a relatively simple mission: collect and analyze intelligence so that American presidents could know each day about the various threats facing the United States. President Truman had not wanted the agency to become America's secret army, but since a vague clause in the National Security Act of 1947 authorized the CIA to perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence affecting the national security, American presidents have used this covert action authority to dispatch the CIA on sabotage operations, propaganda campaigns, election rigging, and assassination attempts. From the start, critics questioned whether the United States needed a spy service separate from the Defense Department. In defending the agency's independence, CIA directors have pointed out what they have that the Pentagon does not. It has a cadre of undercover officers who can carry out covert missions overseas where the hand of the United States is hidden. The CIA answers directly to the president, the argument goes, and can carry out his orders more quickly and more quietly than the military. The residents of the Oval Office have turned to covert action hundreds of times, and often have come to regret it. But memories are short. New presidents arrive at the White House every 4 or 8 years, and a familiar pattern played out over the second half of the 20th century. Presidential approval of aggressive CIA operations, messy congressional investigations when the details of those operations were exposed, retrenchment and soul-searching at Langley, criticisms that the CIA had become risk-averse, then another period of aggressive covert action. Sometimes the cycle began at the very start of a presidency. During his first week in office, President John F. Kennedy told his advisors he didn't believe that the CIA was aggressive enough in Vietnam and set in motion a secret war against Hanoi that would eventually become the largest and most complex covert action of its time. The CIA's ambivalence about carrying out assassinations went back to the spy agency's predecessor, the Office of Strategic Services. Created in 1942 under the leadership of its fierce commander, William J. Donovan, the OSS was a paramilitary organization first, espionage service second. Donovan's glorious amateurs spent much of World War II sabotaging railways, blowing up bridges, and arming Nazi resistors throughout the European theater. Still, even Donovan got cold feet at the end of the war about a program to train assassins to kill Nazi leaders. By 1945, the OSS had trained about 100 Wehrmacht deserters to hunt down German leaders, from Adolf Hitler and Hermann Göring down to every SS officer above the rank of captain. For those organized killings, the agents working for the Cross Project would be paid $200 per month, but the teams were never sent into Germany. Donovan wrote to his staff that such a wholesale assassination program would invite only trouble for the OSS. Instead of killing top Nazis, Donovan said that they ought to be kidnapped and interrogated for intelligence. The war ended before any kidnappings could take place. Decades later, the Senate committee led by Frank Church of Idaho had originally intended to look only at domestic abuses by the agency, such as illegal wiretaps. But in early 1975, President Gerald Ford made an offhand comment to reporters saying that if investigators dug deep enough, they might uncover a number of CIA attempts to assassinate foreign leaders. When his remarks went public, the Church Committee made assassinations the principal focus of its hearings. For 6 months, senators heard about plots to kill Patrice Lumumba in the Congo and to position an exploding seashell near where Fidel Castro snorkeled in Cuba. The iconic image of the hearings came when committee members passed around a pistol that the CIA had built to shoot poison darts, and Senator Barry Goldwater pointed the gun into the air as he looked through its sights. CIA Director William Colby tried to make clear that the weapon had never been used, but the image endured. Before the committee had even wrapped up its work, President Ford signed an executive order banning the government from carrying out assassinations of foreign heads of state or other foreign politicians. If anything, President Ford's assassination ban was his attempt to put limits on his Oval Office successors, to prevent future presidents from being too easily drawn into black operations. The Church Committee pointed out that, for all the CIA's questionable activities during its early decades, it was always the White House encouraging reckless operations like coup attempts and killing foreign leaders. The CIA offered secrecy, and secrecy had always seduced American presidents. As Senator Church wrote in his committee's final report, once the capability for covert activity is established, the pressures brought to bear on the president to use it are immense. Church questioned whether America even needed the CIA at all. Instead of keeping a regiment of cloak-and-dagger men at the president's disposal, Church believed that the State Department would be more than capable of taking on covert operations if the need arose, but should do so only in the case of dire emergency, perhaps to avert a nuclear holocaust or save a civilization. Church didn't get his wish, but the CIA had been duly chastened by the time that Ross Newland graduated from Trinity College in Connecticut in the late 1970s. The son of an international businessman, he had spent most of his life living in Latin America and Spain and spoke fluent Spanish. Given his upbringing and interest in international affairs, Newland figured that he might be destined for a career as a diplomat, but he chose first to pursue a master's degree at the London School of Economics. At an opulent holiday party in December 1978, at the residence of the American ambassador in Madrid, Newland was recruited to become a spy. He had flown from London to Madrid to see his parents, who were living in Spain, and during the party, a man in his early 50s approached him and told him he worked at the embassy. After 15 minutes of small talk, in both English and Spanish, the man asked Newland if he wanted to walk through the gardens of the residence and speak in private. The man was Nestor Sanchez, the CIA's station chief in Madrid and a veteran clandestine officer whose storied career in the Secret Service was in its twilight. An ardent anti-communist, Sanchez had joined the CIA not long after its founding and had been at the center of many of the covert operations investigated by the Church Committee. He had helped engineer the successful 1954 coup against Jacobo Arbenz Guzman in Guatemala, and had given a poison-filled syringe disguised as a writing pen to a Cuban agent in an attempt to kill Castro. Sanchez told Newland he might make a good CIA case officer and gave his name to the agency's station in London. 3 months later, Newland was sitting in a bare room at CIA headquarters waiting for his psychological evaluation. A man walked in, sat down, and asked Newland only 2 questions. "So you grew up in Mexico?" "Yes." "What's the difference between an enchilada and a tostada?" Though puzzled by the question, Newland nevertheless explained the difference between the 2 dishes. After a brief chat about Mexican food, Newland politely told his interviewer that they better start the psychological evaluation because he needed to get to his next interview. "And he said, 'No, we're done,'" Newland remembers. Ross Newland was in the CIA. He finished up at the London School of Economics and officially joined the spy agency on November 5, 1979. It was just a day after students in Iran stormed the American embassy and 6 weeks before Soviet paratroopers landed in Kabul as the vanguard of the hundreds of thousands of troops who would invade Afghanistan over the following months. The 2 events convulsed CIA headquarters, especially the 53 members of Ross Newland's class. Top agency officials ordered all trainees except those fluent in a language not spoken in the Muslim world to be funneled toward assignments in the Middle East or Central Asia. Because he spoke Spanish, Newland was one of a dozen trainees excluded from the draft. By the time Newland had completed his case officer training, Ronald Reagan had become president, and the CIA had a newfound interest in Latin America. Cocaine was flowing over the border into the United States, and the Reagan administration was deeply worried about the growing power of leftist guerrilla movements in Central America. Newland had a mentor in Nestor Sanchez, who by then had left Madrid and taken over the CIA's Latin America division. From his perch at headquarters, Sanchez was able to guide Newland's early career, and he put him at the center of the action. He was sent first to Bolivia, then the world's cocaine capital, where he was directed to cultivate sources in the drug cartels. He spent much of his time in the Bolivian lowlands, posing as an American businessman and trying to make friends among the drug runners in the city of Santa Cruz. He drank with them, bet on cockfights, met their wives and mistresses, and drove with them out of the city to eat duck with mango and pineapple in ramshackle bungalows along the road leading into the jungle. When he wasn't in Santa Cruz, he was in the Bolivian capital of La Paz, awaiting the next coup attempt. The CIA station in Bolivia took pride in predicting each coup before it happened, and the agency officers there didn't want to blow their perfect track record. But Newland got a bracing dose of reality about his place in the world when the one successful military overthrow during his tour in Bolivia earned only a small mention on the inside pages of the New York Times. The previous four attempts hadn't even made it into the paper. The Reagan administration had identified the Bolivian government as a partner in the war on drugs, but as he started to penetrate the Bolivian drug networks, Newland began to write intelligence reports about the rampant corruption among top officials in La Paz, many of whom were on the payroll of the cartels. The Minister of the Interior was protecting the drug kingpins from prosecution, and they were paying him off in ranches, jewels, and cash. The reports were hardly what the American ambassador in La Paz wanted to read. For Newland, the experience in Bolivia was a first glimpse of how Washington's policy of propping up corrupt governments to serve a singular goal, in this case the war on drugs, could undermine long-term American interests. He also began to question whether the CIA should really be in charge of the drug war, or whether the Reagan administration had just leaned on the agency because messy wars are best fought in secret. 2 decades later, he would have similar questions about the CIA's role in the war against terrorists. When Newland was dispatched to Bolivia, the CIA's Latin America division was a relatively sleepy corner of the spy agency's directorate of operations. But it would soon become the center of the CIA's universe, largely because of dynamics many pay grades above Newland. In June 1981, Nestor Sanchez left the agency for the Pentagon. His replacement was Duane R. Claridge, a gin-drinking and hard-charging spy of the old school who was exactly in the mold sought by William J. Casey, Ronald Reagan's newly installed CIA chief. Known to all as Dewey, Claridge grew up in a New Hampshire family of staunch Republicans, his nickname was a tribute to Governor Thomas E. Dewey of New York, and earned degrees from Brown and Columbia before joining the CIA in 1955. He was eager to battle the Soviet Union on each shadowy front of the Cold War. By 1981, he had served undercover in Nepal, India, Turkey, and Italy, often posing as a businessman and using pseudonyms like Dewey Marone and Dax Preston LeBaron. With a high-octane personality and a preference for white suits and pocket squares, Claridge attracted a following among younger undercover officers. He was fond of saying that the CIA's clandestine service marches for the president, but his push for aggressive clandestine operations sometimes infuriated State Department diplomats. Claridge's boss in Rome, Ambassador Richard Gardner, called him shallow and devious. When he returned to Washington in 1981, Claridge quickly developed a rapport with Casey. On Claridge's first day back at CIA headquarters, Casey called him into his office and said that the Reagan administration was worried about Cuba and the Sandinista government in Nicaragua exporting revolution throughout Central America, particularly in El Salvador. Within a week, Claridge came back with a plan. Take the war to Nicaragua. Start killing Cubans. Casey, a former OSS man, embraced the plan immediately. He told Claridge to draft a secret finding for the president to sign, authorizing a covert war in Central America. It was very early into his presidency, but Ronald Reagan was already accelerating covert activities both in Latin America and in Afghanistan, where he increased support to the Mujahideen fighting Soviet troops. Reagan was initiating a new turn of the cycle. The risk-averse CIA was once again running secret wars abroad. Claridge was just the man to be in charge of the Central American front, and he used a CIA slush fund to buy guns, ammunition, mules, and heavy weapons for the Nicaraguan Contras, the rebels resisting the government. He worked closely with the Pentagon's Special Operations Troops and, with an aide at the White House National Security Council, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, to build the Contras up into a guerrilla force he hoped would preoccupy the Sandinista government and prevent it from spreading its influence around America's backyard. The CIA's budget for Nicaragua was tiny. Claridge and the agency's Latin America hands used to joke that the U.S. Navy pushed trash of greater value off its aircraft carriers in a single morning than the CIA had to spend in Nicaragua in an entire year. Ross Newland and many of his peers at the CIA saw the wars in Central America as exactly what the spy agency needed to avoid. But by 1985, Newland's work in the CIA's Latin America division brought him to the heart of the covert wars of the Reagan era. He arrived in Costa Rica just months after a secret CIA operation to mine Nicaragua's harbors had unleashed a fury in Congress and ultimately led lawmakers to put new rules in place about when the intelligence committees were to be notified about CIA covert action programs. The mining operation, which Dewey Claridge claims he dreamt up over a glass of gin and a cigar, cost Claridge his job as chief of the Latin America division. He moved laterally inside the CIA's clandestine service, taking over CIA operations in Europe. In Costa Rica, Newland saw firsthand the war that Dewey Claridge had built. CIA officers in Costa Rica were managing the southern front of the Contra War. The northern operations were run out of Honduras. Congress had, by then, banned the Reagan administration from supporting the Nicaraguan rebels, but the CIA's station chief in Costa Rica, Joe Fernandez, was working with Oliver North to deliver supplies to the rebels. Newland's job was to penetrate the government in the capital of Managua in order to determine the plans and intentions of senior Nicaraguan political and military officials, traditional espionage work. He met with agents, wrote intelligence reports about the strategy of the Sandinista government, and put those reports into the stream of classified cables going back to Langley. What was bizarre, however, was that other CIA officers in charge of running the Contras were doing the exact same thing. American covert officers would make decisions about which Sandinista targets the Contras should hit, and then write up intelligence reports predicting which targets were about to be hit. The cables were sent back to Washington, and, not surprisingly, the predictions were usually correct. The CIA was, in other words, generating its own intelligence. I thought this was so nuts.